Accession number 18463, reel 22.
Reel 22.
I'm sitting propped up in our house, fully clothed, in my sleeping bag, everything possible wrapped around me. I'm also wearing a jeep coat, which I must have found along the way, on top of everything else, balaclava, the whole lot, pile hat. And I just couldn't get warm. I was just so cold, not externally, but internally. My insides seemed to be icy cold. And I was desperate not to go sick, because it was only... four of us left now, NCOs that is, and that meant dividing the night into four. It'd be terrible if you had to divide it into three. And I think somebody must have reported to John Sawbrick, the platoon commander, that I wasn't all that well, because he came and saw me and said, well, the MO's coming up to give everybody an injection. I think it was a cholera, because at this time there was a suspected cholera in 5th Cav, and they'd been quarantined. And I suspect it was a cholera. It could have been for anything. Anyway, the company had formed up in a long line, and he took me over to see the MO, who popped a thermometer in my mouth and said, well, you'll have to keep it in for a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, because in this cold it doesn't register. You know, you can't just... to put it in and take it out again quickly. So I'm standing there on the thermometer whilst he goes off with John Sawbrick, and they start to give the injections, and this long column of the company are going past me and looking at me, standing there forlorn in with a thermometer sticking out of my mouth, and I'm sure they're very amused by it all. And gradually I sink to my knees. I can't stand upright. I'm on my knees now. And I really don't know how long I was there. It was quite a long time, I guess, for 80 or 90 guys to go through and get an injection. But I don't know if I crawled or what I did, but I scrambled, crawled, walked, whatever it was, over to the house quite near where he was giving the injections, and sat on the veranda. And that's where he found me and took the thermometer out. I guess it was half hour later. I really don't know the time. And said it was... I thought he said it was 109, but in retrospect that sounds just a bit over the top, I think. So I suppose it was over 100 anyway, 100 and something. And he said, right, you're off straight away. And I don't know, maybe I went back and got my kit and weapons and all the rest of it. Maybe somebody got them for me, I have no idea. The next recollection is sitting in the back of a 1500-weight lorry, which was taking four or five others in various states of disrepair off to the field ambulance. I can't remember the journey at all. The next recollection, I'm in the field ambulance, and there's always a reception in the field ambulance. They must have taken weapons and away, but I'd still got my equipment and what have you. And I suppose I'd been registered in or something. But two Indian soldiers, very smart young soldiers, got me one on each arm, and they're carrying a stretcher. And they walked me across the base of this place where the field ambulance is, which is virtually in a great big hollow, saucer-like hollow, with a few houses, and some of the houses are up on the side of the hill. We go across the end of the hollow, and we go up a little path, and I can't believe it. It's dead bodies on, it seems to me, dead bodies on stretchers laid there, wrapped up, tightly wrapped up, faces covered with blankets, about 10 of them. Put the stretcher down at the halfway up the path, on, you know, quite a steep path. I guess it was about 30 degrees, something like that. Very narrow path. Put the stretcher down, lay it down, and I think, well, that's it. I reckon I'm past it, and you know, they're just going to lay me here to sort of die with the rest of them. And with a lovely feeling, funny enough, I was, for the first time ever since I was probably a child, I was wrapped up in bed on the stretcher. Blankets wrapped around, my own blankets, and my pack for a pillow, and my poncho around me. And I don't remember any more then for, maybe it was 2 days, I don't know. I don't know, maybe there were drinks, maybe there were pills, I've no idea whatsoever. But suddenly there were shouts and balls and people running and feet running past, and I thought we were being attacked. And I tried to get up off the stretcher. I hadn't got anything, no weapon or anything. But I'd still got my grenades, as it happened, in my pouches, although they hadn't, presumably hadn't known that. And young Indian soldier bent down and said, "It's all right, it's all right. It's only a practice. We do this regularly, and go back to sleep again." And I turned over, and all I could see was wonderful black boots. We didn't have any black. It hairs had gone white. There were these blanco gaiters and boots staring at me, and that's about the last memory I have. The next time I remember, and I think, and I mean, this is just a guess, that it was about 4 days later, somebody was waking me up, and it was an enormous great Sikh with a white beard, wonderful man, you know, really would have made a wonderful photograph or painting. And he's got a plate, or mesting, I think, no, plate, enamel plate, that's right, and an enamel mug of tea and egg and bread, and he's urging me to eat it because it freezes pretty quick if you don't eat it, and I didn't want it, but he made me eat the egg, and I ate the egg, and it was the first egg I'd had, I think, since entering Korea, and I forced some of the bread down and I slurped the tea down. But see, if you put a cup of tea down, anything, or any cup, coffee, whatever it is, on the ground, before you've got time, and you eat your meal, before you've got time to pick it up, it'll freeze to about, I say, half an inch of the top of the cup. And that would just be a lukewarm liquid, so you mustn't put it down. You've got to slurp it all down as quick as you can. And I did my best, and he tucked me back up again, and I went off again. Next day, or maybe later that day, I don't know, I think it was the next day, he was back again. This time I've got bread, egg and beans. And I was feeling a bit better, funny enough, and I ate the whole lot. And he squatted down there and had a little talk with me about India, funny enough. And he was a knowledgeable man, and I wasn't knowledgeable about England. He hoped to compare notes. He was telling me how long India was and how wide it was and the population. And I hadn't got the faintest idea how long England was or how wide it was. I probably knew the population roughly, but I think he was a bit disappointed in me. But he was a lovely chap. He came back each day, and eventually I got up, and they sent down into a hut, into one of the houses, and from then on we had to go to their main mess hall and get our meals each day. And we were in this house there. As we walked across to get our meal, there was one of our own, we knew him in actual fact, not from our company, saw us and darted back in the back of the hut and sort of bit animal-like, funny enough, and sort of wouldn't come out, which is pretty unusual. So we said to one of the Indian orderlies there in the mess, "What's that chap over there then?" Because they took his meals in each day, we realised later. And he said, "Oh, keep away from him. We've been told to tell you, Middlesex people, to keep away from him." So we never did. But it appeared that his nerve had gone. And I guess maybe they had doubts as well about it, because they hadn't sent him off to Japan, which would have been normal. They were keeping him in this house. And they didn't want us, as part of the battalion, to go and talk to him. And we were told not to, and we didn't do it, actually. I must be honest, talking amongst ourselves, we did have our doubts about him, but one can never tell on these things. Eventually, we were taken over to a large tented ward and given blood tests. I think we probably might have been having blood tests on a really fairly daily basis anyway. You know, they prick your thumb and put it on the slide and all that sort of thing. I can't remember. And I can't really remember any medication, but I guess we were having Paludrine tablets because we got malaria. It apparently had lain dormant since the Nakdon days, and it was knocking people out all over the place in the brigade. And eventually, because the battalion was so short of men, we were sent back. He should have had the big Sikh chap told me that you should have 3 weeks. But we had to get us back on our feet as soon as we could, and get us back to the battalion, and without any rest whatsoever. So we went back up to the battalion, and I think it was about the 4th of February that I arrived back, and the company commander just had a quick word and sent me off to the platoon. And they were dug in on a little low ridge and were staying on the positions. We'd moved over here, but apparently the Americans had thought that this place, Yeoju, was still occupied by the Chinese, but it wasn't. They'd been there, but they'd gone. And the Americans were now starting to put a bridge across, and then they were going to go forward of us. And we stayed on that. We dug in on this ridge. I dug a trench up in my section again and took over from whoever it was that had been looking after it whilst I was away. And I don't know why I did this, but I put my bivvy up on the sort of rear slope, and the rest of them were just hadn't got any bivvies up at all. And we had an order that night that they could sleep back in the house, get one house, and they could sleep in there and just keep the LMGs up on the position. And that was okay. That was okay by me because the LMG was quite close to me. And I spent the night there. And then another order came along that we only needed one LMG up there. And I tried to persuade the platoon commander to have the one next to me, because it was funny enough, it had a good field of fire. But he had a view that they should be covering the road, which is a very valid view. And he decided to, about 100 yards away from me, to have the LMG post there. And the most peculiar thing happened now. I put straw in my tent. And I decided to stay up there. The rest of them went back down because I could roll into the trench straight away. Just getting off to sleep, and I heard sounded like footsteps in the snow. Okay, this crunch, crunch, crunch. Hello. Every time I stopped, every time I woke up, it stopped. I moved, and of course the straw was crackling now, and I couldn't make this out. And in the end, I convinced myself that there's a circle of people coming up around me. And any minute there's a long bayonet going to slip through this trench. Tried to undo the flap of the bivouac, which I'd laced at the top. I hadn't laced it right down, but I'd laced the first thing, and they were frozen solid. Couldn't get out. And I slipped out my sleeping bag. And another stupid thing I'd done, of course, was I put my Sten gun by the bayonet, stuck it in the ground just outside the door of the tent. The idea being that if I whipped out quick, I could grab it out and, you know, do whatever was necessary. And I could see my Sten out there. And I can't see anybody out there. I shut out the door, grabbed the Sten up, cocked it and swung round. There wasn't anybody there at all. Not a soul. And cut a very long story short, it was a mouse in the straw. Every time I laid down, he waddled about in the straw, so you know I had a little night where every time I woke up and moved a little bit, he waddled about in the straw, and as I say, the first time frightened the life out of me. I decided that I'd got to get back down to sleep in the hut, because I wasn't going to have that anymore. And the next following morning, my bedding had gone missing, and I'd had to borrow some bedding from the hut. The colour sergeant had lent me some bedding of one of the chaps who'd gone sick. I got up that morning and looked at the bedding. It's alive with lice. I've never had lice before or since. Funny enough, I've been on a course in Hong Kong on lice, but never thought I'd get them. And apparently there are two kinds. One has a spot on the body and the other one doesn't, but I couldn't now remember which was which and didn't think it mattered much. But I was absolutely alive. The bedding was alive. Terrible. Itching, scratching. And I went down with it and took it down to see Albert and said to him, look, this one's burning right away. It's alive. I'm alive. But by this time, he'd found my bedding. But unfortunately, I'm called forward now to go out on a long-range patrol. So I can't really do much about it. Well, I can't do anything about it. And formed up for the patrol. And funny enough, I thought Jimmy Wilde, the CSM, was coming with us because he was fully dressed with all his kit and what have you. I couldn't make that out. In actual fact, he was going home to UK. There's a thing called Python in the army at that time. And I think it was 3 years abroad or something they had to do. And then they went back to the UK. And he'd come to the end of that term and he was off back to UK. I didn't know that, of course. So we're now without CSM. And we're lined up there ready. And John Swarbrick's going with it. And the company commander came over and said to him, "What's Corporal Barrett doing here?" He said, "Well, he's leading the Bridgehouser." "No, he's not," he said. And I thought, "Well, why not?" "No, he's supposed to be on light duties or something," somewhere to that effect, he said, for 3 or 4 days. "So take him off and put someone else." And I felt a bit guilty, really, because poor old Bill Everett had to get his kit out and come up, you know. And they went off for the day. I think that maybe the whole platoon went off, because there were hardly anybody, just the LMGs left. So I set to then to deal with the lice, and I couldn't kill them all. There were so many of them. They were in every... We got long john pants and vests and shirt, you know, Angola shirt and what have you. So I thought, well, there's only one thing. There was a big copper in the house. Got some water, got a fire going under it, and I popped everything in there and sat with a blanket around me. I got them out of my field jacket. I think I got all of them out of my field jacket. And I popped everything in the pot and boiled it up. I thought, we're never going to move with the company on its way, and I don't know what I'd have done if we had. Anyway, it all came out the same colour. It went in khaki and it all came out grey. So I had a grey pullover and a grey shirt and grey long johns and all the rest of it, but it didn't matter. And I kept the fire going and dried it, most of it out, in front of the fire, and got it all back on again before they came back. And I was lice-free from then on, thank goodness. But in the meantime, while I'd been waiting for them to come back, I thought to myself, I'll make them a nice toilet. You know, a real fancy toilet. So I dug a hole and did the old business there. And I went off to a house, one of the houses there, to look for something to make a sort of seat that they could sit on. And we've never had one of those before. I went into this house, and unfortunately the civilians in there were using half the house to live in and the other half for a toilet. And it was pretty indescribable all over the floor there. And I found a chair, so I took it back, chopped part of the legs off, took the back off and put it over the toilet. And when they came back, I said, "They are the best toilet you've ever had." And they all said, "If you think we're going to go up in front on that hill and use that where everybody's watching us, you've got another thing coming." So it never was used. But it was a fantastic toilet. If only I could have found some sacking to put around it, I'm sure they'd have used it. Anyway, I was a bit disappointed with that. A couple of days later, we went off on a company patrol. It wasn't so much a patrol. We went off down the river and dug alternative positions, because the feeling was that the Chinese, they were going to attack shortly anyway. Everybody was aware of that. And we put a company down the river, which of course was frozen solid. I mean, there was no barrier to them at all. We could go over, they could go over. And the Aussies came up behind us and went a little bit farther down the river. And we dug in on the forward edge of a village. The most peculiar thing here, one of the houses there had a piece of wire around it with little green bits of foliage on it. And we didn't know what it was, so we broke it down. There were obviously some people in the house. We were going to sit in the trenches all night. And as they were digging in, we heard a terrible shout from the right, Bill Everett's right-hand LMG section. And we went over there. Apparently they'd got their trench, lovely trench they dug, well camouflaged and everything. And they'd seen a shiny bit of pottery in the side of the trench. And one of them had rather foolishly put his pick through it. And it was a great, I can only call it an Alibaba thieves' jar, full of excrement. And it had flooded their trench and got them up to above the level of their gaiters. And they were leaping about there a little bit upset. And demanding that we move them right out of the way. Well, we couldn't do that. So we just told them to fill it in and just dig an alternative trench, which upset them a little bit because the ground was pretty frozen, and dig a little bit to the side. But that stench was indescribable. So they tied handkerchiefs around their noses and dug this new trench. In the meantime, we had a quick look in the house behind, because we were thinking maybe overnight you know, we might be able to make use of it if you know, we weren't allowed to, as it happened. But there's always the thought in your mind you might be able to. And it was full of sick people. And they waved us away. You know, go, go. And we realised then that this wire round and these little bits of tree green foliage on it had been a signal to everybody that this was literally a quarantine. So we spent a reasonable night there. And the following morning, they decided to try and break the ice. First of all, with the 25-pounders. And they had to wait for a bit because it was literally a roadway, the continual streams of civilians going, mainly heading back up towards Sewell. It was always a good sign that the enemy's not around, although there were soldiers, rock soldiers, occasionally coming back, going t'other way. Anyway, they waited for a break and it didn't do any good at all. It just, they exploded rather nicely and sent, you know, a lovely cone of fire around, but they didn't break the ice at all. Then they tried with the American 4-2 mortars. We had an American 4-2 mortar company with us, which had joined us before Christmas. And they tried, and it didn't look like it was doing any good at all. But of course, you've got to be sure. So we were sent out on a long-range patrol then to go out, check the ice, and then we had to go somehow or other, go to the opposite shore and check around there. Got out there, and there was just the usual black mark, dinner plate. No effect at all on the ice. Although had anybody been coming across it, of course, it would have done them a bit of mischief. But on the far bank, the ice had broken away. It wasn't the shelling, I mean, it was just nature. It was just, so we couldn't get straight across, so we had to go upriver. And I guess we must have gone about half a mile upriver. And the civilians were passing us by. Terrible, absolutely terrible scenes. I mean, they were not dressed in winter clothing at all. And one of them, one group, they had a tall, skinny girl, lanky hair, dressed in American long johns, that's the ones that with a button-up bick on the back, and a pair of boots, and she was blind, and they were sort of towing her along on a rope, and I must admit that we did wonder whether she was destined for a watery grave. There wasn't anything we could do about it. We've got a job to do. We went on, and we came up to a place where there was a little island. There were like two little islands, and a narrow, about, I guess, 50, 60 yards across, and in here the ice had piled up, and it would be just like if you got a flat piece of pastry and pushed it up, it was all rippled and in little mountainous things about a metre high, very, very difficult to get over. And up on the left hand hillock, island or whatever you like to call it, was an American heavy machine gun post with a black chap on sentry up there, and when we got close, he did the old traditional thing of, "Hey, who that down there?" And we burst out laughing. Of course, you can imagine the wag is calling back, "Who that up there then?" And he got a bit miffed, to be quite honest, that the platoon commander, Judd Swarby, had to stop us and call out, "Commonwealth Brigade." And he hadn't got the faintest idea of the Commonwealth Brigade. And, "British Commonwealth Brigade." And he wagged us on. Not too pleased with our humour, I guess. And we got through here, and we managed now to turn to our right, which would be like north, in actual fact, and get across the river. It was like a landing area here. I think I would hazard a guess that in happier times and when it wasn't frozen over, boats probably landed there. And we did we went up tactically up here, and there was a little village on the top. And we cleared the village, and I cleared the right-hand flank, Bill cleared the left. But the houses were full of people, very, very sick people. And up on the right-hand side, I went up a bank, and there was a chap there. He was in a grey serge trousers and a grey shirt, nothing more. It must have been frozen. And he pointed to a little, like a wigwam of wood, not covered in, just pointed together in a point, and indicated to me that's where he lived. And I thought, this can't be. He's got to be a soldier of some sort of kind, you know. And I went to put my finger in to see if he got any sort of means of identification around his neck, and he jumped back. I said, "No, And he was covered in lice, actually, so I wasn't too concerned. I got the interpreter come forward, and he said he couldn't tell me what it was, but it was obviously, he wouldn't get near him either, it was obviously some terrible disease, and I've often wondered what it was. And I thought it might have been leprosy or something like that, and presumably he'd come from some hospital or home or whatever, just dressed in this grey trousers and shirt. And he was living out in this this little wigwam. So we left him, went on a bit, and it was a house full of absolute chocker of young people of, I might add, military age, women, girls and boys together, and they really didn't want us to go in, or and we chose not to to look around. They were obviously trying to dodge military service in the Rock Army. The interpreter said that they always said this, the people, many Chinese, a couple of days ago, well, they might have been rocks, they might have been Chinese, but there obviously been somebody there, you know, quite recently. And as I say, the houses were full of sick people, and what they were doing was, they were, the children who, it was smallpox, incidentally, we weren't sure of this, but we thought it must be smallpox, and the children had got great big blobs all over them, which apparently they were better. They were as fit as little fiddles, the children. They must have had it, and it had gone away again. And the older people were using the children to feed the very old people who were, well, I think probably dying. Because I followed one of the little girls over to see where she was going with her bowl of rice, and there were obviously grandparents or something just laid on the floor and in a very bad state of repair. And they gave them the food, and I don't know whether they ate it or not. But we then returned back and reported what we found, and the MO decided that he'd take a party over, and poor old Bill Everett had to go back with the MO, and he said, well, it was smallpox, you know, and if you hadn't had a smallpox jab for 6 months, then you'd better have one quick, because, you know, it was pretty contagious. So he said, he said to me personally, have you had one for 6 months? I said, yes, oh, I definitely got, hate having injections of any kind. But he went away, and I thought, well, this is stupid, isn't it? I'd better have the injection. So that evening, they got a jeep up at Company HQ, and I don't know how we did it, but 16 of us got on this jeep, somehow or other, hanging on, sitting on the bonnet, and eventually drove us over to the MO. We all queued up there, all 16 of us, very, very brave, and trying to make sure we're at the back and who's at the front. And a little boy came up, I guess, I don't know how old he was, 10 maybe, perhaps younger, had his sleeve rolled up. We said, yes, you can try it first. Pushed him up the front, and he was as pleased as punch. But they didn't give you an injection. What the MO did was he had a scalpel, and he made two, maybe three or four little scratches on your arm, and then he wiped a sort of paste into the cuts. I think he put a plaster on. I can't remember. I mean, he may not have done. I think he must have put a plaster on or something, and away you went. But the little boy was as pleased as punch with this. He went to the back of queue, and he wanted it again in the other arm. But I'm afraid the rest of us were a little bit, you know, not too keen on things like that. Anyway, we climbed all back on the jeep again and had a fairly interesting ride back. And that was our introduction to smallpox. I can only imagine that hundreds, thousands of people, civilians, were dying of smallpox at that time, which I think is one of the problems at that time in North and South Korea, although of course later people will try and say that it